after a while, but eventually it becomes clear who the prophets of God are. And I don't think Karl Marx ever claimed that for himself. And this is an interesting feature of the manifestation and prophet of God, is he tells you who he is. That's very challenging. We don't like that. We don't think it's modest. We have different problems with it in the West. You know, how can he say he's a prophet of God? He can say he's a prophet of God because he is a prophet of God. You know? Either you're a prophet of God or you're crazy if you say you're a prophet of God. Has it gone off again? All right. So the book addresses the question of certitude in a very broad way. And it weaves together in patterns which are not normal literary style as far as we're concerned. It unfolds patterns within patterns. And it brings up subjects and then returns to them again later. So that it's not neatly organized like a university course or something of the sort. It flows, it gushes, it bubbles, it shines, and it does it, alternates these patterns as we've seen. And now, how many of you have read the Igon, read the Kitab-Igon? Well, that's a help. How many of you are going to read the Kitab-Igon? Okay. The versions you may have in front of you may not be this one. The American Publishing Trust edition, Shoghi Effendi first sent the Igon manuscript to them to publish, has maintained the same pagination over their various editions. The British, however, have another page numbering. Now I have a set of sheets. If you have the British edition, which somebody can hold up, it's the other red one, this is a key to the page differences. So when I say turn to page such and such, or tell you about something on page such and such, you can find the page quickly if you have this key. So maybe some of you will help pass these out. If you raise your hand if you need one of these keys, okay? If there's not enough, we can take down a list and get some more. Anybody on this side need it? A few. Are there people that need one, need this sheet that don't have it still? A few, two, three, four, five, okay. If you'll give your name to Brita after class, Brita, can you raise your hand so then we'll arrange to get more copies of it, all right? The Igon was revealed in Persian by Baha'u'llah. It contains some Arabic paragraphs and passages, but for the most part it is in Persian. At the beginning of the book, there's this short foreword signed Shoghi. Shoghi Effendi wrote this, and as you'll see, he says, "This is one more attempt to introduce to the West, in language however inadequate, this book of unsurpassed preeminence among the writings of the author of the Baha'i Revelation. The hope is that it may assist others in their efforts to approach what must always be regarded as the unattainable goal, a befitting rendering of Baha'u'llah's matchless utterance." I've sometimes heard it mentioned, or thought, that this very humble statement by Shoghi Effendi implied that others would come after him and improve on his translations. I don't think that's what he's saying if we look carefully at it. He has offered this as an assistance to others who will attempt to translate Baha'u'llah's writings. And so it becomes a standard, really, for the Baha'is, because it is certainly unattainable in the excellence of its approach, and I don't think there's any thought that anyone will outdo it in the future, because there's not going to be anybody with that interpretive capacity of Shoghi Effendi that could cast the intention of Baha'u'llah that he's drawn out of the veil of words and cast it into English phrasing of the sort that Shoghi Effendi has done. But by translating terms that might otherwise be obscure and impenetrable for Westerners, in this book, he's provided a basis, along with this and the other writings that he's translated, to create a resource to which translators can turn. In fact, in the Kitabi Akdas project, all of the Arabic writings of Baha'u'llah were compiled, along with the Persian writings also, which contain a number of Arabic terms, and matched against the original, the English translations against the originals, so that we could see what the precedents were for the various terms which appear both in the Igan, for example, and in the Kitabi Akdas, and see in what manner Shoghi Effendi rendered these. Now, it's not an exact mathematical combination, because oftentimes he would translate things in different ways in different settings. So there's a lot of flexibility and a lot of poetry in his approach. But it does give some range of possibility to the translators, and it tends to hold the body of translations in a more homogeneous state, if you will, as we add more and more of Baha'u'llah's works to our collection of Western Baha'i writings. So that when you're reading about something in one book and you find this a further explanation of it in another book, you can figure it out because the terminology is the same. This, however, is not the case with Some Answered Questions, which was translated before Shoghi Effendi's time, and it takes quite a bit of study, as I'm sure you're aware, if you've tried to coincide passages of the Igan and Some Answered Questions together, to think what exactly is Abdu'l-Baha's intention here. How does it relate to Baha'u'llah's writings? There's many coincidences of terms, but they're translated in slightly different ways, and it's not always self-evident. But as you look at the context, you look at the statements that are being made, you can see the parallel meanings and gather them. And I think that Some Answered Questions will go through some stage of retranslation and revisions in the future to bring it in line with Shoghi Effendi's masterful translations also. For some years there was a preface to the book, introduction if you will, but the House of Justice decided that the sacred text now should be published, now that the faith has come to the stage that it has, that it should be published without introductions by people other than the manifestation. So we have these now without introductions, although there are many books will no doubt be composed, many courses are being composed to introduce these books to us, but then that's something separate from the sacred text itself. Shoghi Effendi has chosen this passage to adorn the opening of the Kitabi Igan. It says, "This is the day in which the testimony of the Lord hath been fulfilled, the day in which the word of God hath been made manifest, and his evidence firmly established. His voice is calling you unto that which shall profit you, and enjoineth you to observe that which shall draw you nigh unto God, the Lord of Revelation." Now in this time of fairly easy word searches, we can maybe find out where this is coming from. I've never check to see if it's someplace else, if it's been translated originally for this. I don't believe it's from the Igan itself, but it's here both in its original form, if you have this edition in front of you, and with its translation. You'll notice that the Igon consists of two parts. Those of you who have read it will be reading it. The first part is a little shorter than the second part. Each one of them is prefaced by an Arabic paragraph of Baha'u'llah. We'll just read those two paragraphs to get a little of the flavor of what he, the heading, if you will, that he gives to the section. He starts off, "In the name of our Lord, the Exalted, the Most High." This is the Aliyul Allah, the title of the Bab, the names of God that have been particularly applied and adopted by the Bab. So he's really saying, in the name of the Bab, in a sense, in the name of the Bab. And this book is written in defense of the Babi revelation by one who ostensibly was still a Babi, though we know he was the manifestation of God, and he knew he was. At that time, he had not yet made his declaration. The Igon has been revealed prior to the time that Baha'u'llah declared his prophetic mission. So he is a loving teacher here, and he's constantly deferring to the Bab, if you will. He's explaining the reality of the Bab's mission. In a number of spots, which we will identify and find through the text, he alludes in a very thinly veiled manner to his own position, or to the proximity of the Promised One. In the opening passage then, he writes, "No man shall attain the shores of the ocean of true understanding except he be detached from all that is in heaven and on earth. Sanctify your souls, O ye peoples of the world, that haply ye may attain that station which God hath destined for you, and enter thus the tabernacle which, according to the dispensations of providence, hath been raised in the firmament of the Bayan." As you peruse the first part of the book, you'll realize how important these words are and how they are the essence of what Baha'u'llah is really teaching here. That if you consider the standards and ideas of human beings as a means or proper balance to discover the validity of God's, the messages of God's teachers, of God's manifestations, you'll never attain to a true understanding. He says it requires detachment from all that is in heaven and on earth. Now, naturally, we come at the beginning, we come equipped with an inheritance of things that human beings have taught us, that we've learned from our parents, from our school teachers, from our culture, from our environment, from things we've studied independently afterwards. And so we have these veils of acquired learning to some degree, depending on this, the grace of God on the one hand and the state of our soul on another. We feel an attraction to Baha'u'llah and to his writings, or maybe we feel it through the Spirit acting in the Baha'is, and we've been attracted to it. And now we know this is Baha'u'llah's work. We're going to decide we're going to penetrate this somehow. We're going to try to understand it. And yet we find ourselves using certain standards of reason and thinking that sometimes interrupt the flow and intention that Baha'u'llah has. We have to work our way back, and we have to see. Wherever we trip, usually we're tripping over something that is in the way of baggage that is not necessary for us anymore, that we need to eliminate. But this is a process, of course, I think, of a continued prayer, of study, of self-observation, to see what are those things that keep us from drinking in full what Baha'u'llah is saying. Naturally, he also addresses our minds and our reason. It's not unreasonable. It's just that sometimes our way of reasoning is not up to the divine standard, if you will. It doesn't come, it isn't arise to be able to match this, or it doesn't have that open receptivity which would allow the meanings of the text to imprint themselves upon our hearts. There may be some other veils over our hearts. There may be some heavy coverings over our hearts. They may be sealed under a bushel, as Baha'u'llah says in the Seven Valleys. Gradually we have to work ourselves out from underneath these things. The whole purpose of the book is to help us find our way out. And it points, particularly in the setting of the East at the time that Baha'u'llah appeared, although it transcends that and addresses all human beings of all times, it does answer the doubts and concerns of the maternal uncle of the Bab, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, who addressed questions to Baha'u'llah concerning his nephew, the doubts that he had about the station of his nephew as the promised Qayyim. And it was in the context of those questions that Baha'u'llah revealed the Kitab-e-Ghan as a response. And for many decades it was known as the epistle of the uncle rather than as the Kitab-e-Ghan. And later Baha'u'llah himself in a tablet said that this book should be known as the Kitab-e-Ghan. He talks about sanctify your souls, O ye peoples of the world. Again, this is that process of how to reach the detachment that he's calling for, if I understand it, the intention of it. That haply ye may attain that station which God hath destined for you. You remember the hidden words, be thou content with that which we have ordained for thee. Of course, this is not something simple. I mean, each one of us is the center of a configuration, if you will, of divine names and divine qualities, a unique expression of God's creation. If we can draw out that potential in ourselves and allow it to shine in the world, then we will have attained this station that God hath destined for us. He certainly hasn't destined us to be attached to the things of the world and to be dull and to be unattracted and unstimulated by the word of God. It's the opposite. He wants us to come to a state, it would seem, of sanctification that would allow us to drink in everything that he's ordained. After this Arabic explanation, Baha'u'llah begins to explain the same passage in Persian. Here we go to the head of the second part, page 97. Verily, he who is the day star of truth and revealer of the Supreme Being holdeth for all time undisputed sovereignty over all that is in heaven and on earth, though no man be found on earth to obey him. He verily is independent of all earthly dominion, though he be utterly destitute. Thus we reveal unto thee the mysteries of the cause of God, and bestow upon thee the gems of divine wisdom, that haply thou mayest soar on the wings of renunciation to those heights that are veiled from the eyes of men. In my own way of looking at this, I see that this calls for even a further stage. You have a detachment and then you have a renunciation. You detach yourself from all things and you leave them behind, so to speak, renounce them. And this allows for different grades of understanding and perception to take place in our hearts and in our souls. There's a story in the East repeated in the writings referred to in the Ghan itself, will come to that part alluded to, if you will, about 3 degrees of knowledge. The knowledge of seeing something, or the knowledge of hearing about something first, the knowledge of seeing it, and the knowledge of attaining to it. Usually in the writings of the mystics of the East, they use the example of fire. They say you have the example of hearing about fire. Now that's one level of understanding. Somebody tells you how it is and you try to imagine what is it that they're talking about. If you've never seen fire, you wouldn't quite get the idea, you know. It's a difficult concept. And then the second stage of this is seeing fire. Now things have become much clearer. There you see the fire and so on. But the third stage, he says, is to be in the fire and burn in the fire. Then you understand this. Now, this station of certitude has been identified with this station of burning, actually, in the fire. Now, there's this state of perception, of spiritual perception, which banishes all doubts and misgivings and misunderstandings, against which no human view or limitation impedes the progress of the soul. Now, the Gan and our prayer books and all of the verses of God really are made to help shred these veils, to remove these veils from us by degrees. It depends on an act of will on our part, on a growing degree of intense desire to attain to the gift of the scripture. And these words create in us this longing. Sometimes they create this longingness because we don't understand anything and we're frustrated and we want to understand more. We would like to see. What is it he's saying? I know there's something here, but I don't get it. And then we pray and we long. And gradually we fill ourselves with interest in spiritual themes. Now, do you remember that Abdu'l-Bahá says that you become... He repeats, this is a phrase from the past, from philosophers too, you become what you think. In other words, what you're dwelling and thinking about, that's what you will gradually become the content of your being. If you are focused on spiritual matters, on spiritual truths, and trying to understand them, they will gradually possess you, if you will, in the positive sense. They will be with you all the time. You will reflect on them. And in the midst of your other activities, maybe washing your clothes or whatever other thing that you have to do daily, these things come out. My wife says the most spiritual hour is washing dishes. I'm so glad about that for my But she says when she washes dishes, she this is the time that her, you know, you don't have to pay so much attention. It's something you know how to do. I envy you people that have jobs here where you're doing the same kind of physical routine things, and sometimes you say to yourself, this is such a boring job, I have to do the same thing over and over again. Here you are in the shadows of the shrines doing this boring job. You can occupy your thoughts, unless you're a security guard, watch out. You can occupy your thoughts with spiritual subjects. You can memorize verses and passages from the Gan, or write them out on a little piece of paper, keep them in your pocket, you know. You have a break every half an hour, you stand up to stretch your back, and you take this out and you say, now I have to remember this. And you think about it some more. You can use the hours that you have in service of the cause for reflecting from time to time. Try to remember, try to use it, take advantage of it. Because there's not all that much time in our lives. We're busy with other things, and we need to be busy with other things. Where can we find time to keep heating up, if you will, the core of our being, our heart, and thinking about these things and dwelling on them? The success that we might have in approaching this book will depend on the intensity of our spirit of search. And so it's not so much what we discuss here as what each of us longs to discover from the book in the course of our study and consideration of it. Is there another book that should be more important for us to study? We have the writings and letters of Shoghi Effendi indicating that this is among the most essential, if not the most fundamental book for people to study, to understand the cause and to understand the prophets of God. In the Gan itself, Baha'u'llah on page 237 states this, the following, most amazing. He says, all the scriptures and the mysteries thereof are condensed into this brief account. All the scriptures and the mysteries thereof are condensed into this brief account, so much so that were a person to ponder a while in his heart, he would discover from all that hath been said the mysteries of the words of God, and would apprehend the meaning of whatever has been manifested by that ideal king. This is another wonder of the Kitab-i-Gan. It is a key to the scriptures. as you absorb the various principles that it sets forth, you will be able to look at the holy books of the past and discern their intention and meaning. And Abdu'l-Bahá, to some of the teachers, early teachers in the West, some of the women that wrote him asking the meaning of different verses in the Bible, he would call on them to read the verses of God, to pray, to turn to the Holy Spirit, and you will be able to expound the meaning of the scriptures in the meetings. And of course they did, and they did some in their writings too. There is this flow of inspiration which comes, which corrects our thinking, which guides us, which projects into our consciousness the intent and purpose of God in his verses. So you'll want to mark this passage perhaps in your book, page 237. The materials that we're using here have evolved in courses given here, I think, since about 1980, and the various aspects of the course, and as I stressed in the title, this is really an introduction to the study of the Agon. Even though we're going to study the Agon, it's still an introduction to the study of the Agon, because one can never really attain to writing, I think, or preparing a proper study of the book. Because of its magnitude, it's elusive. Some of the themes that we'll be covering deal first with the importance of Agon and its study, which we're talking about this evening, and then the significance of the Agon and the historical circumstances of its revelation. And Shoghi Effendi has written something about this, and we have other historical accounts about the uncles and so on that we'll want to go into, a little about the meaning of the Promised Qayyim, something of the history of the manuscript of the Agon from the beginning. The Agon's been translated into many languages. We'll take a little look at that also. Then we'll be considering major themes of the Agon as identified by Shoghi Effendi in God Passes By. And we'll discuss various aspects of the text, hopefully in a series of classes which will survey very broadly 50 pages of the book at a time. Now, that may be too much for you to read during 1 week. So if you're rereading the book during these two or three, four introductory classes before we get to the text, if you read ahead in the book, you'll at least have that started. There are questions that are raised as you read. If you either write them down or tick the margins or something, we can have time for questions in class and see what we understand by it and what the rest of you understand by it. Perhaps we can come to some clarifications that will be helpful. The importance of the Agon in its study has been commented on by Shoghi Effendi in various places. He characterizes the Agon as a unique repository of inestimable treasures, occupying a position of unsurpassed preeminence, as we mentioned, among the doctrinal writings of the author of the Baha'i dispensation. He reiterated then throughout the course of his ministry the importance of studying the Agon carefully, thoughtfully, indeed of even mastering its contents. He's hinted in several places that the Baha'i should master the contents of the Agon if they wish to be successful teachers. There are a number of quotes. I'm going to read a few of them to you. Each one of them seems to heighten the interest and quicken the initiative of any student, would-be student of the Agon. Back in 1923, he said, "The sacred books are full of allusions to this new dispensation. In the Book of Agon, Baha'u'llah gives the keynote and explains some of the outstanding passages, hoping that the friends will continue to study the sacred books by themselves and unfold the mysteries found therein." Again, he says the Agon is the most important book written on the spiritual significance of the cause. Now, these are letters that are letters of his secretary, which he's, as we understand, has dictated to the secretary, but they're in the Shoghi Effendi has said mode rather than Shoghi Effendi speaking in the first person. Most important book written on the spiritual significance of the cause. The Agon is the most important book wherein Baha'u'llah explains the basic beliefs of the faith, says in another letter. You should form study classes and read the important books that have been published, especially the Agon, which contains the basic tenets of the faith. The one who ponders over that book and grasps its full significance will obtain a clear insight into the scriptures and appreciate the true mission of the Bab and Baha'u'llah. Again, Shoghi Effendi hopes that you will exert all your effort to deepen your knowledge of the literature of the movement until you become fully acquainted with its spirit and tenets. Unless you do obtain such a firm hold, you will never be able to teach others and render real service to the promulgation of the faith. Of special importance is the book of the Agon, which explains the attitude of the cause towards the prophets of God and their mission in the history of society. Besides this, there is some answered questions of the Master and Dawnbreakers of Nabil. Every Baha'i should master these books and be able to explain their contents to others. Besides their importance, they are interesting and most absorbing. For those who think, well, I have to study this because he says I have to study it, he adds this nice line about actually you'll enjoy it. If you get into it and do it, you'll really enjoy it. In another letter, he says he fully approves the idea of holding study classes, for the deeper the friends go in their understanding of the teachings, the more firm and steadfast they will become, and the more unwavering in their support of the institutions of the faith. Books such as the Agon, Some Answered Questions, and the Dawnbreakers should be mastered by every Baha'i. Well, there's a university education for you. These three books, mastered by every Baha'i. In his letters, I think we spoke here about, in the discussion about study, ideas for study of the faith, that Shoghi Effendi in his various letters, he talks about the Baha'is, calls on them to read the letters, and he calls upon them to read the writings, and calls upon them to read and reread the writings, to deepen, to ponder, to digest, to master, and to memorize. So you've got this scale that you can perceive if you look in the various letters. The mastery is pretty far along, just short of memorizing. You should understand the contents, be able to repeat them to others. If you can do it using passages, phrases, sentences of the text as it stands, of course that will be more powerful in its effect. He says about these books, they should read these books over and over again. The first two books will reveal to them the significance of this divine revelation, as well as the unity of all the prophets of old. Again, he says it's the most fundamental book on the Baha'i Revelation. He's very eager to have this wonderful book translated well, for it is the best means of grounding those who become interested in the fundamental teachings of the faith. The Agon and Dr. Esselmont's book will be sufficient to make any seeker a true believer in the divine nature of the faith. This particular letter was written to Leonora Armstrong in South America. Shoghi Effendi was guiding her in her teaching work. She was the first pioneer to Latin America. She went to Brazil. She followed in the footsteps of Martha Root. Martha Root had gone as a traveling teacher. Leonora Armstrong, Leonora Halsapple in those days, Leonora Halsapple Armstrong, followed in her footsteps but as a pioneer and became the first pioneer to Latin America of the cause. And Shoghi Effendi has referred to her here as the Peter of South America, as the spiritual mother of the continent. So many lovely things he said about her. And he nurtured her from afar through his letters. And he encouraged her to translate the Iggon. It was the first book. The New Era actually was the first book, and then the first book of scriptures was the Iggon. And after that, passages from the Dawnbreakers, which exactly parallels and coincides with what he's saying we should study here. And in his letters to her, he mentions how useful that she will find the Iggon for teaching the public. Now, oftentimes we think, oh, the Iggon's too hard to give to a seeker or to someone who is inquiring about the faith. We should know that this book has the capacity to teach the cause in a very special way. And depending on the circumstances, passages from it or parts of it can be shared with the seekers. He says these two books will be sufficient to make any seeker a true believer in the divine nature of the faith. The Book of Certitude by Baha'u'llah contains the very essence of the teachings, and because of its clarity and its relative simplicity, can greatly appeal to every thoughtful reader. The Iggon deepens the knowledge of the reader by acquainting him with some of the basic theological problems of the faith. It's therefore indispensable for every student of the movement. Again, he says, he was particularly gratified to learn of your intention to make a thorough study of the Kitab-e-Iggon during this summer. This was written to a gentleman and happened to be from the States who wrote to Shoghi Effendi, said he was going to study the Iggon over the summer, make a proper study of it. Shoghi Effendi says, the friends and particularly those who wish to become competent and useful teachers, not brilliant, outstanding teachers, competent and useful teachers, should indeed consider it to be their first duty to acquaint themselves as thoroughly as they can with each and every detail contained in this holy book, so that they may be able to present the message in a befitting manner. That's what I read this letter before I had made much study of the Iggon, and that was what got me started making these courses, was actually this each and every detail line. Each and every detail. You give the word read the Iggon once in a while, but each and every detail. Acquaint themselves as thoroughly as they can with each and every detail. So that's your challenge. It's the guardian's hope, therefore, that those among the believers who have thus far, and for some reason or another, failed to make a serious study of this important work will be stimulated to do so, and will, as a result, deepen their comprehension of the essentials of their faith. Do you have any questions that you'd like to ask, or any comments that you'd like to make up at this point? Anybody? Yes?
Usually you hear more than the three, usually you hear five different books that people suggest that you study. What are the other two?
Well, I think Gleanings in the Epistle have come into some of the lists. If you look in the book, in this compilation, The Importance of Deepening, there are various other ones too. I chose the ones that stress the Iggon, but there are others. And even Shoghi Effendi has referred to his own writings, not too often, but obviously they're essential things for us to read too, like God Passes By, the Dispensation, and so on. But Gleanings is one of them that he included after. Actually, at this point, I don't think it's when some of these letters were written, the Gleanings hadn't yet been published. And in the Gleanings, Shoghi Effendi has chosen to create six sections of Gleanings that are made up of passages and extracts that he's selected from the whole of the Kitab-e-Iggon. And we'll look at those at a certain stage, because in a sense he's drawn out those things that he feels, I think, to be the most essential. And even more than that, his summary of the most critical principles of the Kitab-e-Iggon have been set forth in the Dispensation, where he quotes a few key passages out of the whole book. And I like to think that these are things we should focus on. In fact, in you may wish to do something like this in my copy of the Gan. I like making a book my own. I'm not too worried about marking up books. I know that if anybody's here from the library, they wouldn't like that. But if you own the book, I don't know why you can't mark it yourself. I have put blue lines around anything in the Gan that's quoted in the gleanings, so that I know that this is one of those parts that Shoghi Effendi has selected for the gleanings because of its importance. So that's an interesting study in itself. There's a key to that you can discover later on. And then actually within that I have some other green boxes, and these green boxes are the portions that Shoghi Effendi has cited in the dispensation, where he's explaining the basic principle of progressive revelation. So, and you saw some red underline, you may wonder what that is. Those are corresponding entries in the Qamusi Gan in Persian, which is a four-volume encyclopedic reference work that was prepared by Isha Khavari, that some of you, I think, heard Dr. Rafati speaking about his life some weeks ago. He has created a guide, a rather broad, ample kind of a guide on various topics and subjects from the Gan. And in the notes in this course, some of that's been drawn from that material, some of which hasn't been published in English. It helps to clarify certain verses and passages that might be obscure, remain obscure to Westerners without some help, because there are background and circumstances there that we don't have always at hand when we're studying. Now, put together a few quotations too with regard to the study of the Gan and the study of scriptures in general. Read some of this for you here. The Gan has been described by Baha'u'llah in one of his tablets as the Sayyid Kutub, the Lord of Books, the Prince or Lord of Books. Any penetration of its meaning obviously requires careful and prolonged study. Baha'u'llah himself clarifies in the Gan, with regard to the reading of the scriptures, he says that this is for no other purpose except to enable the reader to apprehend their meaning, the meaning of the scriptures, and unravel their innermost mysteries. Otherwise, reading without understanding is of no abiding profit unto man. It's page 172 of the Gan. The understanding and comprehension of his words, he further affirms in another passage, are in no wise dependent upon human learning. They depend solely upon purity of heart, chastity of soul, and freedom of spirit. Interesting terms to think about. Purity of heart, chastity of soul, and freedom of spirit. Understanding and comprehension of his words depend on these three things. It's curious in the, and highly significant that the faith has clarified that knowledge, the deepest of knowledge, is dependent on virtue. That without virtue and good character, we will never since these truths are as if they were projected from God into our being, if the screen of our soul, so to speak, is all muddied up, we don't see the images clearly. But as we cleanse ourselves through prayer, through service, through meditation, through fasting, through all the means that have been provided, gradually the veils lift and we become more and more excited with the discoveries we make, if you will, in the writings. And this seems to be implicit in this question of purity of heart, chastity of soul, and freedom of spirit. Knowledge is not dependent on excessive reading and on efforts, although that's helpful, not excessive reading, but reading and efforts are part of it. But that isn't going to assure you of penetrating the meaning of the text. This has to be wed to the system of Baha'u'llah in the Kitab-i Aqdas, the laws, obeying the law of God. All of this together creates in us that condition, that state in which we can achieve the deepest understanding. This is, at least this is what the things, the verses indicate to us. In this process, we shouldn't feel unduly discouraged if our grasp seems too limited, because obviously the book is not something that you can finish with. It will serve us all of our whole lives. Its meanings, I'm sure, will carry with us into the other world. We have to approach it. Each time we approach it, we will surely, even just reading it through and then starting through again, we're already changed by the first reading. When we come to the second reading, we'll have different significances and further meanings that we wouldn't have discovered the first time. There's almost a cycle of continual studying and absorption in the themes of the Iqan. True progress in this regard, as we're talking about, is conditioned by the progressive unfoldment of one's own inner spiritual state. In the Iqan, page 70, Baha'u'llah says, "The heart must needs therefore be cleansed from the idle sayings of men and sanctified from every earthly affection, so that it may discover the hidden meaning of divine inspiration and become the treasury of the mysteries of divine knowledge." The Guardian, I think, what he's referred to this soul in one of his letters as the repository of the ancient mysteries of God. The soul is the repository of the ancient mysteries of God. Though in its individualized form, each of us has a beginning. We are conceived, and the teachings tell us that at that moment we come into our individuality and have a beginning. Yet what we are made up of in our innermost essence is eternal in character. So as we come to identify with that aspect of our being rather than with our external public personality, if you will, or the experiences we have outside of us, but we draw on this repository within us, this effulgence emanating from God, which is our inner being and is our inner reality, as we come to identify with that, as we become of those two categories of believers that Abdu'l-Baha mentions in one tablet. He says that there are some believers who are like plants, and through the light they grow and develop and they unfold their unique beauty and the flowers of their being. He said there are other believers who are like rays. Now ray has nothing but the personality of the light. It doesn't have anything fancy and individual about itself. But it helps the other plants grow. It helps the plants to develop. So he talks about both of these, and he says he hopes that we will become like rays. Now, if we identify with this, then we come to identify with the eternal part of our being. And we come to discover that our souls indeed are repositories of eternal mysteries. What does Baha'u'llah say in the Hidden Words? He says, "Possess thou a pure, kindly, and radiant heart, that thine may be a sovereignty ancient, imperishable, and everlasting." The reality of man moves from contingency to eternality. It's a very mysterious. He's confined here first in a very limited way. Gradually liberate themselves spiritually through the influence of this breath of God that causes the awakening of this new way of thinking, this new way of seeing, a new eye, a new ear, a new consciousness, a new mind. And in that becomes identified with the eternal world. Takes on the qualities of the kingdom of God, which is eternal. And in the process becomes an eternal being. Partakes of eternal life. Not from now on, but the whole thing. Because in the world of the kingdom there's no beginning and end, of, if you will, of sorts. Now we can't understand that, we're in a world of time and space, but I think this is what they're hinting at in these writings, is that we actually begin to identify, we begin to taste, if you will, we begin to perceive the fragrance of that eternal aspect of ourselves. It comes out and we resonate with the other world. And then he says, you will become creatures, you will become the angels of heaven though you still walk on earth. He talks about that. Remember Abdu'l-Bahá in the Divine Plan, he calls on the believers to become incarnate light. What's he telling us? He says then to that degree, of course, that light, which is the very essence of love, the love of God, this light is not just light like this light. We know it's a spiritual light, it's a revealing light, it's a warming light, it's an illumining light. This light then is used by the teachers of the faith to endow others with spiritual awakening, spiritual awareness. Now, one time there's a story, one of the gentlemen that was attending to Baha'u'llah in the house of Abud, he came with a tray with something to offer to Baha'u'llah. Baha'u'llah was standing in the window towards the sea, looking out, and he had a book in his hand. And this gentleman came to the threshold and waited there for Baha'u'llah to recognize him. And Baha'u'llah said, I'm reading this book. Do you know what this book is? He said, no, he didn't know. Baha'u'llah said, this is the Iqan, the Kitab Iqan. He says, it's a very good book. I recommend it to you. And this man has written this down in his diary. The Baha'i scholar Mirza Abul Fazl, one of the means of his attaining really to the acceptance of the cause was the perusal of the Kitab-e-Iqan. And we have the testimony that after the master, he was the great teacher of the cause. He himself has recounted to Ali Kuli Khan that he'd read the Iqan with the eye of intellect 17 times through, and it had seemed to him a meaningless string of words. But later he had read it with the eye of faith and had found it the key with which he could unlock the secrets of all the sacred books of past religions. This is quoted in Dawn Over Mount Hira, page 112. Marzia Gale's written about this from her father's memoirs. By an intensive study of the Iqan, we will be addressing, if you will, the requirements of Baha'u'llah when he says, immerse yourself in the ocean of the words of God. For the purpose, he says, that ye may unravel its secrets and discover all the pearls of wisdom that lie hid in its depths. Abdu'l-Bahá, in his turn, counsels the would-be student to investigate and study the Holy Scriptures word by word, so that you may attain knowledge of the mysteries hidden therein. How many times this word mysteries keeps coming up over and over again here? Things that we hadn't known and we couldn't even imagine. I mean, literally, mysteries are of that sort, things that you hardly expect to come across. And that we should not be satisfied with words, but we should seek to understand the spiritual meanings hidden in the heart of the words, Abdu'l-Bahá says. This is a very interesting talk in the Promulgation of Universal Peace, page 459. Shoghi Effendi reassuringly affirms that the more we read the words, the more will the truth they contain be revealed to us. And again, if you read the utterances of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá with selflessness and care and concentrate upon them, you will discover truths unknown to you before and will obtain insight into the problems that have baffled the great thinkers of the world. So our small study class takes on very great proportions when we think of what the outcome can be for us as we approach the study of this book. In these written notes, they said that there's one note of caution, or surely there's many, but one note of caution that's put here, is that the truths of the Iqan are best acquired within the context of its own wholeness and in the light of Baha'u'llah's other writings. To quote from Shoghi Effendi, "We must never take one sentence in the teachings and isolate it from the rest." And again he says, "We cannot divorce the letter from the spirit of the words. As Baha'u'llah says, we should take the outward significance and superimpose upon it the inner. Either without the other is wrong and defective." He talks about this in the meaning of wisdom in a tablet where he explains the meaning of hikmat or wisdom. And he says that the intention of God is whatever is written in those verses, that it may have spiritual meanings, but you should not bypass the obvious external meanings of it. You know, for instance, when in the obligatory prayer it says wash your face, some of the mystics and so on have said that this obviously refers to your spiritual face and you should wash it with the waters of eternal life or something like that. And he said, and then the result of that is you're going around with your face dirty when you want to say your prayer because you put all spiritual significance to it. That you should see to the surface meaning of it, but it may have these other significances as well, but don't give up the outward for the inward. But rather, as he says here, superimpose the inner upon the outward. Well, I suppose this is, we learn to do this, we have to think of this in terms of the hidden words too, which we're enjoined to study and to read every morning and evening. You know, it talks about reading verses morning and evening. Abdu'l-Bahá also says we should read every day the hidden words. This is one of those places where the superimposition of the inner on the outer meaning becomes very significant. Well, these are a few thoughts about the study of the Quran, the study of the scriptures itself. Certitude seems to be mentioned in a number of passages in the Quran in different contexts. He speaks here of the path of certitude, the sheltering shadow of certitude, the way of certitude, the light of divine knowledge and certitude, the fruit of certitude, the cup of certitude, the essence of faith and certitude in another passage he refers to. The water of certitude, that's from the hidden words, in many different contexts. Where Abdu'l-Bahá describes the stages of the soul, he speaks about the inspired soul, which is really the first solid state of a soul that attains to that. And prior to the stage that he calls the inspired soul is the self-accusing soul, or what you may be seen in the gleanings, a stage of the soul referred to as irascibility. When the soul is irascible with itself, it's self-accusing, because the light of God is penetrating and sparking this darkness of its own condition, and this light is disturbing it. You know, when it was a perfect brute, it didn't bother with any concern about anything. This introduction of the spark and inspiration of God occasionally in its existence leaves it uncertain about the reality of the darkness it was living in, and seems to tell it that there's another condition, a higher condition, a luminous condition. And it can then not just be content with its previous ways, but begins to accuse itself, concern itself. It's disturbed. And of course, if it exposes itself to the revelation, it sees all of its shortcomings and begins having to struggle with those. And the soul is never happy with itself. It keeps looking at itself. This is not the way I'm supposed to be. It does know what is really right and what's wrong, and it does things and gets itself in trouble and realizes this is not right and tries to redress and go back. And Abhrabhat says, gradually the soul moves forward through the grace of God, thank goodness, moves forward to a stage that he calls the inspired soul. And he says this inspiration has to do with the soul being inspired with the difference between good and evil. It now becomes clear to the soul what's proper and what is improper, and therefore is able to guide itself, or is guided, if you will, by the light of God, to move on the path of spiritual progress. And so when it moves off of this, it immediately feels indications. The heart begins to cool, and the soul trembles that it's somehow I've missed the direction I'm supposed to be going. As soon as you get off course, you feel it in your being. You're uncomfortable, you're not happy, you're disturbed, you're concerned, you're remorseful. And you bring yourself, you find your way back to the center of wherever the inspiration is coming from, and pursue it. After that, he says, you attain the stage of assurance. The soul becomes the assured soul, which is the same root as the certain, you could say, the certain soul. That is, you attain to the stage of certitude. And it talks about the great rejoicing that takes place in the soul when it attains to that. Because now these doubts and misgivings, as you said earlier, drop away from it. And it shines in this light of divine knowledge and certitude. And it's identified, if you will, with that holy fire that was burning in the heart of Moses. Now that fire begins to burn in the seeker's heart. And in the face of that, no shadow can penetrate to disturb his faith and his serenity and his assurance in the blessings of God and the purpose of God and the intention of God for his being and for his connection that he has with the Beloved, which becomes so strong and then is like an anchor, which then moves the soul, Abhrabhat says, through a number of other stages. This becomes, gradually reaches to a relative stage of perfection. Though perfections are endless, yet it's no longer burdened by imperfections to the degree that it was before. And its knowledge is clear, and the fruit of its being ripens to the stage where it becomes pleasing to God. God is pleased with the soul, and the soul is pleased with God. And then he says it moves from there into the shores of the soul of the kingdom. Now we always say, well, we'll see you in the kingdom, you know. But you hear all these stages in Abhrabhat's writings in different places about the stages of the soul and all the things that have to be attained before you ever reach the kingdom. And you say, well, we hope we'll see you in the kingdom. I hope I will see you in the kingdom. This panorama, this wonder world, if you will, of our own inner realities. This world that we might think of as addressed by Baha'u'llah when he says, close one eye and open the other. Close one to the world and all that is therein, and open the other to the hallowed beauty of the Beloved. This is the world that the Agon leads us to and opens panoramas for us that we might come by degrees, by stages, through each and every detail, so to speak, to a greater understanding of this fundamental truth of the cause and the wonder of the gift of God through Baha'u'llah to us all in this day. So we'll take up some more things next week.